Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. Today, the 9 spices that will decrease your triglyceride levels by 30%, and that could help prevent a heart attack. Disease does not stand a chance against one nutrient. What is that one nutrient that I would put against almost any condition out there? I'll tell you. And it's inexpensive and easy to take. Mindfulness treatment is as effective for depression as medication. How does our environment damage our DNA? And how does that lead to disease? In France, the hepatitis B vaccine sparked a wave of new cases of multiple sclerosis. Why are we even taking the hepatitis B vaccine? I'll get with that, because I believe that's one of the ones you should absolutely challenge for your newborn baby. I'm going to give a formula today, a simple one, so write it down, please, to help protect your breast from breast cancer. Also today, I have a friend who is concerned about having a stroke, and they want to put him on statins because of some of his blood chemistry. I took a look at his blood chemistry. To me, he doesn't need the statins. He needs a healthier endothelium, so I'll be giving everyone in the audience an opportunity to take some notes when I do an in-depth discussion about how to enhance your endothelium, reverse plaque buildup, heal the scarring that leads to clotting. Information from James Harrison. It'll help a lot of people today. We're going to save lives. Then, also today, I'm going to get into our environmental segment. I'm going to talk about the environmental bubble. What do I mean by that? I mean, we know we have a housing bubble and a bond bubble and an equities bubble in Wall Street. But we also have an environmental bubble. And those people who believe that they should rejoice because China and the United States have agreed that over the next 30 to 50 years they're going to do something to lower carbon emissions, they better be aware that long before that, this bubble is going to burst. And when it does, there's going to be devastation worldwide. I believe it's going to be bursting in the very near future. I'll discuss that. New information as published in Counterpunch by Robert Hunzinger. Then today, the flu mist vaccine, why you should question it. First, if you're Jewish and observe kosher rules, it's got pork in it. That's right, it is not kosher. Porcine, gelatin in flu mist, plus a lot of the things you wouldn't want in your body. And there's no evidence that it actually prevents the flu. Then also today from our public health segment, how the Affordable Care Act fuels corporatization of American health care. I have a lot of problems with Obamacare. I'll explain just some of them today. And for those of you who are willing to listen from a reasonable point of view, I think you'll see that the corporate Democrats and the corporate liberals that wanted us to support this, saying it's better than nothing, are then asking us to select the worst of many evils. We should have universal health care. This is not it. We should have good quality medical care. We don't have that. In fact, one of the leading physicians, MD, PhDs in the United States, will be on my program next week. And she will tell you how bad American medicine is. Mind you, she is Harvard-trained, mainstream MD, PhD professor, and she didn't believe it until she did her homework, and then she found out what a disaster American medicine is. So I'm going to go into this in a little depth today and show you that from the very beginning, Obamacare was conceived by, written by, and promoted by the pharmaceutical industry and the private hospital industry and the insurance industry. At no point did it have anything to do with allowing us to be healthier. Also today, the double standards on banks and crime. And, time permitting, the IRS is seizing people's assets. What crime? No crime. What punishment? No punishment. What's the problem? Well, they just emptied out your entire bank account of everything you have in the world. Well, how'd they get away with that? They're getting away with it every day. That's not cool. You bet it's not cool. Continuing with my series on why we should abolish these draconian laws, these drug laws in the United States, Jack Cole, a former New York City detective, talks about the war on drugs. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. Well, we all want to have healthier blood chemistry, and most people never see their blood chemistry. Therefore, they wouldn't know if it was good or bad, whether what they were eating and drinking was bringing them closer to having a heart attack or stroke or cancer, diabetes. But there's one fraction within our blood called triglycerides. Triglycerides, when they're elevated, are dangerous. They put us at risk of having heart attacks and strokes. New research led by Professor Sheila West from Penn State University, published in Nutrition Today, did an analysis of some of the antioxidant-rich spices and herbs that are known to impact our blood chemistry and bring down elevated triglycerides. And that's good. Triglycerides are also called blood lipids. It just means fats. No different if you called cholesterol. It's called a blood lipid. Now, here they are. Very simple. So if you want to help lessen your chance of a heart attack or stroke by 30%, having these with a meal, or just throw them into your smoothie. Either way, it works. Ready? Garlic, rosemary, oregano, cinnamon, cloves, paprika, turmeric, ginger, and black pepper. Quote, the metabolic effects of spices and herbs and their efficacy and safety relative to traditional drug therapy represents an exciting area for future research given the public health significance of cardiovascular disease. That's what they wrote. So, these don't have the calories, but they do have the taste, and you can put them in different dishes, or you could just throw any combination of these into a drink, and you got it all. If you didn't get them, if I was a little quick there, let me do it again. Garlic, rosemary, oregano, cinnamon, cloves, paprika, turmeric, ginger, and black pepper. Now, I would add some more, but that's from the study. And if you can bring down your triglycerides by 30% by something that easy, then you just reduce your chance of having a heart attack or a stroke. Now, I'm looking at people every day who have some very damaged biochemistry. Almost everyone I counsel has inflammation. Cancer is massive inflammation. Diabetes is inflammation. Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, dementia are all inflammation. Macular degeneration and cataracts, inflammation. And of course, fibromyalgia and arthritis are inflammation. A lot of times you have to ask the person, how much are you willing to do? Sometimes it's the older they are, the less willing they are to make change. If it's only one part of a couple, one of the persons wants to see the other person's health improve, but the person who's sick doesn't want to do anything, it's challenging. So you have to work with what you have available. Younger people tend to be far more open and willing and motivated to make major changes. The quantum changes generally come in younger people. The piecemeal changes come in older people. There's certainly exceptions to that, however. But the more comfortable you are in your lifestyle, the less radical is going to be your change. So this is a non-radical protocol. Normally, there might be 60 or 70 changes. Here is just one, because this will make an enormous difference. It is called Nigella, N-I-G-E-L-L-A, Sativa, S-A-T-I-V-A. It's also called black seed or black cumin. And it is, in my opinion, the most powerful anti-inflammatory in nature. I've been able to look in the medical literature and find more than 100 diseases that it works in. In fact, there are more than 450 peer-reviewed studies in the peer-reviewed literature on black cumin. It'll help Alzheimer's, hepatitis C, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, you name it. And in a study I was just quoted, it was interesting, it says, quote, Dr. Gary Noll stated, every time you take black cumin, you are stimulating your immune system to fight on your behalf and increasing natural killer cells, thus referring to its ability to improve the immune system and to help treat even the most impossible invaders like cancer and HIV successfully. Research at the Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson showed that Nigella sativa could cause cell death when used against pancreatic tumor cells. The results showed an 80% success rate. This study on pancreatic tumor cells was only the beginning of many future studies on the effects of Nigella sativa against cancer. And then it goes on from there. The latest is from Dr. Erfart at MD, PhD, Associate Professor of Surgery at College of Thomas Jefferson University. Quote, Nigella sativa helps treat a broad array of diseases, including some immune and inflammatory disorders. Previous studies also show anti-cancer activity in prostate and colon cancers, as well as antioxidant, anti-inflammatory effects. Well, here's what I've also found that it works with. All the people that I work with who have age-defining illnesses, they're on a lot of things, by the way. I probably have nearly 80 different elements with a protocol. And I've published this in the Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients at length. In fact, it was the longest article in the history of the Townsend Letter on successfully helping people with age-defining illnesses. And it describes it. I published over 17 articles on helping people with age-defining illnesses using natural protocols. But if you're helping someone who's as seriously injured biochemically as AIDS at end stage or cancer, then everything else is a lot easier. For example, it's a natural painkiller, hence it's analgesic. For all forms of bacteria, it's an antibacterial. It is the number one anti-inflammatory, better than the omega-3 fatty acids. For those who have ulcers, it's anti-ulcer. For those who have candida, it's your best anti-candida. For those of you who have hypertension, it's a terrific antihypertensive, antispasmodic, it's antiviral. It's a bronchodilator, which helps people with asthma and chronic congestive pulmonary conditions. It is also a great hepatoprotective, meaning it protects your liver. It's insulin sensitizing. It's an interferon inducer. It's a leukotriene antagonist. It helps your kidneys because it's renoprotective, and you also get tumor necrosis factor alpha inhibitor. Those are some of the things you can get. So when you look at the most deadly form of cancer, which is your pancreatic cancer, it's the fourth leading cause of cancer deaths in America, and because the survival rate after 5 years is only 4%, and that is one of the things I would definitely suggest with any of that. So another way to help save lives. A good study from Lund University, that's in Sweden, showed that group mindfulness treatment is as effective as individual cognitive behavioral therapy in patients with depression and anxiety. Now, What does this mean in lay language? It means that there are times when people are best helped in a group. I've seen this for a long period of time, where people are having difficulty on their own, but in a group setting, like a health support setting, they have been able to make major changes. And by the way, if you listened to yesterday's program, and if you didn't, you can download it on the archives, you heard more than a dozen individuals who have just completed a three-month health support group with diabetes for the people who are no longer diagnosed as diabetic, even though they've been diabetic and taking medications for years and years, one for 20 years. Another person had a 400 drop in blood sugar, another 100-point drop. Blood pressure was improved and made normal. Loss of body weight, energy improvement, pain reduction, and mood improvement. Now, that might have been possible individually, but each person said it made a lot of difference than being in a group together. So keep that in mind. If you're having trouble making changes as an individual, there are multiple health groups around the United States, around the world. I would suggest get into it and see if the group setting doesn't help you. I've suggested for a long time that people living in Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York City, Pittsburgh, very polluted cities, they don't give themselves a chance to get out and really get clean air, lots of environment, stimulation. It damages our DNA. You need green space. You need clean water. You need de-stress. Well, the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences has identified for the first time how damaged molecules become inserted into the DNA strand from our environment. And these molecules may contribute to some disease like cancer, diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, and lung disease, and trigger cell death. Now, this was published in the most prestigious journal in the world called Nature. So researchers from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences describe how they used a technique called time-lapse crystallography to take snapshots of biochemical reactions happening within cells. And with this technique, the researchers were able to observe for the first time how DNA polymerase, which is the enzyme that assembles the building blocks of DNA, known as nucleotides, weaves nucleotides into the DNA strand. I don't want to be technical here, but they also witness how when damaged DNA is inserted into the strand, it creates a fissure that the usual DNA repair mechanisms are unable to repair. This is from the study. Quote, the damaged nucleotide site is akin to a missing plank in a train track, said Dr. Samuel Wilson, senior researcher on the team. When the engine hits it, the train jumps the tracks and all the boxcars collide. Well, the damage to the nucleotide is caused by the oxidative stress. And that's when let's say you're exposed to chemicals in the environment, at work, at home, in your garage, because most people have an attached garage. And because a lot of people want their garage to be warm, they vent their heat from a kitchen into the garage, not realizing that everything in the garage goes right back into the house, including carbon monoxide and any chemicals and paints. And that's when your nucleotides become oxidized, and then they carry an extra atom, oxygen atom, and oxidized nucleotides are usually kept tightly under control, but if they begin to outnumber undamaged nucleotides, the DNA polymerase adds them to the strand. I'll put this in lay language. When you are in any polluting environment, you're damaging your DNA. You need to be spending more time with clean air, drinking clean water, and de-stressing. That's the takeaway message. Now, from our environmental segment, as I've been working now for 8 years on a major new report, it's over 1,800 pages thus far, and a film on the 12 tipping points, I have seen for a long time that there is a giant environmental bubble. And according to all the science that we have, the good science, the Arctic sea volume of ice is diminishing by over 50%, for example, since 1980. That's huge when you lose 50% of sea ice. Now, why is that important? Because the Arctic sea ice, when it starts to do this rapid loss, you end up having the bubble that is global warming burst. And then you have massive amounts of methane, the CH4, trapped in the ice and under the ice. Now, we're now concerned about our major pollution from CO2. Well, let me tell you something. You're not even in the same league when it comes to methane as you are when it comes to CO2, carbon dioxide. And it would be the world's worst nightmare. There is nothing environmentally outside of a massive 30 solar storm that could hit us. In fact, one was just measured yesterday, which was the largest in history. Fortunately, it's not projected at us. But imagine, for example, and I'll just give you the math on this. Right now, we're looking at a relatively small amount of carbon dioxide compared to methane. Methane is thousands of gigatons trapped in ice for the millennia. So when you start diminishing the sea ice, then you warm the water, and methane trapped in the ice, but more often, thousands times more methane trapped in the shallow seabed, in the mud down there. So as that warms, it starts to release that methane gas. Plumes of methane have now been recorded that are half a mile across. Now, sometimes people were concerned when they were 2 or 3 inches. Now we're talking about a half a mile. And that is your global warming bubble, because you don't see it. You don't know it's there. You might read an article that's been published on it, but no one's doing anything about it. But they should, because when that bubble bursts and you have methane in Greenland, you have methane in the Siberian tundra, you're going to have methane at the base of the Himalayas. So that's going to cross the tipping point real fast. And once that starts, it'll be so fast that you won't be able to stop it. For example, at the Earth System Research Laboratory in Mauna Loa, Hawaii, CO2 in the atmosphere is currently 396.91 parts per million. That's bad. Now, that was just as of last week, which is 42% above the baseline for measurement of CO2. Generally, the baseline value is 280 parts per million as its base for changes, and we're almost at 400. So let me put that in perspective. We've had natural and anthropogenic changes in atmospheric CO2 over the last 1,000 years from air and Antarctic ice, and the CO2 level is where the rubber meets the road for global warming. Right now, we're at 400. We're adding 2 parts per million of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere every year. And unless we're able to reverse this and get it below 350 parts per million, we will trigger a tipping point that will be irreversible, and that will send climate change into the ending of probably 80% of the life as we know it on Earth. It'll change it, that much life. From a report, quote, "The warming Arctic is but one of several ominous signals. The others are the Pine Island Glacier, 37-mile ice tongue, is already at a tipping point which could trigger a massive collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which at least would cause massive flooding of low-lying terrain like Miami, but nobody knows when." Now, so you say, so what is this 37-mile ice tongue? Well, it's what's behind it, and that's your West Antarctic ice sheet. So once that goes away, once that tips, and it will in the near future, then everything behind it will start to crack and because of gravitational pull, it'll start to pull off, and because there's underground volcanoes warming underneath Antarctica, it'll just slide in. And when that slides in, it's going to do it all at once. There's also an ice cap at 18,000 feet above sea level that's lost 1,600 years of Andean ice gone within the last 25 years. By glaciological standards, that's global warming on steroids. In the Southern Ocean, acidic water caused by too much CO2 absorbed by the ocean is degenerating the skeletal structures of the bottom fish, and those of the food chain, the major food source for everything from krill to whales. And just keep this in mind. One of the leading respected climatologists and an Arctic expert said this in a tweet, quote, "If even a small fraction of Arctic seafloor carbon is released in the atmosphere, we're finished." And, quote, "massive plumes of methane escaping from the Arctic seafloor." That was Jason Box. So, for those that go on the media and talk about the nonsense of global warming, look how cold it is, look at these freezes, look at the snow, and then laugh about it, keep in mind that your lack of awareness of science and history and doing your homework is putting you in a vulnerable position. And if you're a policymaker, an opinion leader, it's putting a lot more people in a vulnerable position. Because we're just a hair width away from having a major environmental collapse. When do I think it'll happen? Well, let's go back to when they said that that major break-off of the Larsen B shelf. I looked at the scientific literature, and they said it would be anywhere from 100 to 250 years. It happened 29 days later. That's how wrong they were. I believe that we'll see major environmental disasters, either solar storms, massive earthquakes, 5-category hurricanes and possibly higher, worst typhoons, a scorched earth, high heat, and freezing. Both ends are caused by the same phenomena within the next 2 years. I hope that I am wrong. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference. And one of the differences is that we have misplaced our energy on all of these foolish patriarchal wars. The war on cancer, the war on AIDS, the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on terrorism. All of them are massive failures. All they do is benefit those who are smart enough to figure out how to control where the money went in each and every case. I'm looking at one at a time. Today we're looking at the war on drugs and what a disaster it is and why we should stop it, let the people out of prison, and do it correctly.
I spent 26 years in the New Jersey State Police. 14 of those years I worked undercover in narcotics. I retired a detective lieutenant from that job. But when I retired, I felt very bad about my role in implementing what today I feel is not only a failed war on drugs, it's far worse. It's a self-perpetuating and constantly expanding policy disaster. And there's no way to fix it. There's no way to patch it up or repair it. We got to end it. We got to end it like we ended alcohol prohibition in 1933. When I went in the state police, it was 1964. That picture in the upper left-hand corner is a picture of when I graduated that year. And right underneath it is a picture more or less of when I graduated from their narcotic bureau. I went into narcotics in 1970. That was the beginning of the war on drugs. When I joined the state police in 1964, we had 1,700 troopers and we had a 7-man narcotic unit. Always seemed perfectly adequate for the job we needed to do. 6 years later, we had exactly the same numbers. And it was adequate, because when we started the war on drugs, we really didn't have much of a drug problem in the United States. What little drug problem we did have was mainly soft drugs, drugs like marijuana, hashish, some LSD, psilocybin, the mushrooms, the mind-bending drugs. You know, the hard drugs, such as heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, were virtually unheard of back then. Certainly unheard of compared to what they are today. And if you go back and you look at the statistics from 1970, you'll see that the likelihood of anybody dying that year in the United States as a result of the drug culture was less than the likelihood of them dying from falling down the steps in their own house. It was less than the likelihood of them dying from choking to death on their own food at dinner. But we started a war on drugs. So you got to wonder, what was really the purpose behind this, right? In October of that year, thanks to this funding policy from the federal government, we went from a 7-man narcotic unit to a 76-person narcotic bureau overnight. All paid for by the feds. And this was replicated across the whole United States. Now think about that. When you increase the number of cops with one job to do by 11 times its size, you set up a great deal of expectation. Expectation with us in that coming year was that we were going to make at least 11 times more drug arrests than we did the year before, and we were literally off to the races. That's how this thing became a numbers game with the police. It's all about numbers. After 2 weeks training, they had the 76 of us line up and count off 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Every third person became an undercover agent. I was one of those three, so that's where I spent most of the next 14 years of my life. When we hit the streets, we were supposed to arrest drug dealers, and that was really hard because, as I just said, there weren't many drug dealers around. They weren't in, certainly in their suburbs, they weren't in rural America, they weren't in our schools. So instead of targeting us on drug dealers, they targeted us on young people, folks like you, people in college, people in high school, or in between. And when I would weasel my way into these small friendship groups, groups of 10 or 15 young people, come Friday night, they're out of school for the weekend, or if they're working, they're off work for the weekend, somebody might say, hey, you want to get high? And if nobody said that, that was my job. So if anybody took me up on that offer, then one of the friends who had access to the family car or some other way to get to the city would go around to the others and say, hey, you want to get high tonight? Some might say, I'm studying for a test Monday. I'll catch you next time. Others might say, yeah, you know, while you're in the city, pick me up a couple joints, will you? Or they might say, you know, I hear there's some really good blotter acid out there. If you run across any, pick me up a hit of blotter acid. One dose of blotter acid, LSD. When they'd come to me, I'd put my order in for that same tiny amount of drugs. We're talking maybe $5 worth of drugs. They'd jump in the car, off they'd go to the city. An hour later, they'd come back and they'd hand those things out to their friends. When they handed it to me, they became a big-time drug dealer. Because that's what we labeled them. And that is what stuck. And I'd stay in that group until I got every single friend in the group. It was really easy to do because these people weren't drug dealers. They were young folks doing what we used to call dipping and dabbing, experimenting with drugs, and then accommodating their friends. They weren't making any money on this. They weren't even getting their gas money back for that trip to the city. So the second night, that person didn't want to make the run. Second night is person B, and third night is person C. And I would stay till I got every single person in the group. And I might be working 10 of these little friendship groups in different suburbs at the same time. So very quickly, I would come in with cases on a lot of people. About every 2 months, I'd come in with maybe 100 people that I'd had cases on like this. We'd have a big raid. 5 o'clock in the morning, we'd swoop into their neighborhoods with hundreds of cops, and we'd kick their doors down and drag those people out in chains. When we got them all down to the police station, we would have already alerted the reporters to be there with their cameras and snap their pictures and the perp walk and splash them all over the front page of their local paper, destroying any credibility, any respectability that these young folks had. When we got them all lined up against that back wall, my boss would come out. And he'd say to those reporters, "You see that? You see that? There's 100 major drug dealers we took out of your community. This is the worst thing that has ever happened in America. This is going to destroy society as we know it. And your only hope is that thin blue line of police. We need more money so we can hire more police. We need faster cars and better equipment and radios and guns that shoot a whole bunch of bullets and bulletproof vests. We need harsher laws. We need mandatory minimum sentences. We need 3 strikes, you're outlaws. We need. And the reporters would go away and write horror stories, scaring the public to death. And the public would read those stories and say, give it to them. And then we'd go out the next year and do even worse. And we've been doing that now for 44 years. Every year, worse than the year before. Now let me tell you about those young folks. What happened to them? Back in 1970, we only had one law about drugs. It wasn't like it is today. That law said it's illegal to distribute a controlled dangerous substance. And then it gave you a big long list of those substances. There was not even anything in that law that said any money had to exchange hands. Well, when Mr. Clinton was smoking but not inhaling was exactly when I was doing this to those young people. And he was college age at that time. Well, let me tell you, if I would have infiltrated his group, it would have been curtains for Mr. Clinton. You know, drug use is a very social thing, especially soft drug use. 6 folks get up in a circle, spark up one joint, take 2 tokes and hand it to the person on the right. And it comes around the second time and people are getting high and they're not really concentrating on what's going on too much. So the second time around, the person hands me what's now a roach. And I grab that thing and act like I'm what we used to call bogarting the, like I'm going to smoke it all myself. But what I'm really doing is I'm knocking the flame off the end of that and sticking what's left of it in my pocket. Because that night, I'm going to submit that as evidence that the person who handed it to me is a major drug dealer. So if Mr. Clinton had been in that circle, it wouldn't have mattered whether he inhaled or not. The mere handing of that joint to me would have confirmed that he would never be an attorney, much less the President of the United States. So with that one law, since it was only one law, everybody was being sentenced exactly the same. 7 years in state prison. 7 years. Now, they all had to serve a third of max before they could come out on parole. So 2.5 years after each one of these raids I had, another 100 young folks were coming out of prison. What were they going to do? We'd snatched them off the streets in the prime of their life when they're trying to get their education. They don't have any education. And if they did have education, who the hell's going to hire them? They're dope dealers. That's what we said they were. So what are they going to do to feed their families, huh? what they're going to do is they're going to turn right back to the drug culture, the very group we say we're trying to save them from. Only now they're going to become real, honest-to-goodness drug dealers. And for every new real drug dealer, you got to have a whole bunch of new real drug users. So every one of those folks is out there actively recruiting younger people to pick up those needles and become the next statistic. And that, folks, is how this became a self-perpetuating, constantly expanding policy disaster.
Jack Cole, retired New Jersey detective, narcotics detective. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us today? I'm going to talk about the endothelium and how you can prevent blockage of arteries, de-occlude your arteries. Also, I've got a formula for women who want to care about their breasts enough to prevent breast cancer. Breast health formula, let's call it. And then I'm going to take calls. I'm going to have a talk back segment today. 888-874-4888. But I also want to mention that I'm going to be hiring for a couple weeks as part-time people who are just going to be doing scanning documents. I have a million documents in my office that have to be scanned and then all those things shredded because, we don't need to keep them on paper anymore. It's a paying job and paying a good amount of money per hour. If you're interested, call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. And also, we're going to be doing some cooking of brand new vegan, wonderful recipes. My daughter Shelley is going to be the one responsible for doing it. It's not a cooking class, not there to teach about cooking. But if you want to try your hand at four or five recipes and you get to take what you make home with you, so you get like home meals you can take home free, and then it's my way of testing and seeing whether or not the average person can make the recipes that I prepare, and I'm on a scheduled deadline. Now, the ones for Saturday and Sunday are filled, but that means Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week, and then the following Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So you can give a call at 646-926-5422 if you'd like to try some cooking of recipes and see how you do. And if you make some mistakes, Shelley will be there to kind of guide you through the process. Now, for women's health, of course, there's a great deal more than this that's necessary. But again, I have to look on the scale of who's willing to do everything and who's willing to do a lot less. So we want to help no matter where you're at on that motivational scale. So number one, and you already know what to not do because I've gone over that about gazillion times. But phytoestrogens block the bad estrogen from exerting its harmful effects. These are the called 2. The bad ones are 16. And all the good phytoestrogens. So incorporate more phytoestrogens. Then next, get plant lignans, L-I-G-N-A-N-S, lignans. They favorably alter estrogen metabolism. Then get more cruciferous vegetables, because in those cruciferous vegetables you have a chemical called I3C, indole-3-carbinol. It increases the good estrogen while reducing the bad estrogen. Broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, kale, mustard, radishes. Then take calcium D glucarate. Glucarate is GLU, glu, CAR, CAR, 8, ATE, glucarate. It safely facilitates the removal of harmful estrogen from the body. Then vitamin D3 promotes healthy genetic regulatory switching to aging cells, so those at least can get you started, and that can help. Now, for those of you who have clogged arteries, I told my friend who, he's an eternal pessimist. If it was sunny out, my friend would say, you know, the sun's too hot. He's always looking at the dark side of life, which is unfortunate, because he also has a brilliant mind, and he's not going to end up having a heart attack or stroke because he's on a good protocol. But his doctors try to convince him otherwise. And I told him a story about how a man came to see me at the age of 74 who had massive blockage of arteries, and they were suggesting surgery, and the man was an engineer. And he said, the odds just don't look good. He said, the odds look like I have a 16% chance of dying on the operating table for this surgery and a 25% chance of dying within the next 4 weeks afterwards. I don't like that one in four death idea. What else can we do? His family were made up, his wife, his daughter, physicians, and they weren't into this at all. But I gave him a protocol, and within 1 year, he had reduced his occlusion by 90%. And he went on to become one of America's legendary athletes. He and later his wife were outstanding male and female athletes of the year for the USA, the American Athletic League, the Metropolitan Athletic Congress, New York Road Runners Club, I think for like 8 years. So he was able to show what you can do. We're spending billions of dollars on cholesterol-lowering statin drugs like Lipitor and Crestor. Why? Because that's what the doctor is told is the best approach. And well-intentioned doctors are going to use what they're told. And there's a lot of promotion of these drugs, lots of money spent by detailed reps and by other ways of getting this into the doctor's mindset. But the doctor's not told that the number one way to help prevent a heart attack or a stroke, especially if there's occlusion, blockages, is to rejuvenate the endothelium, endo, E-N-D-O, thelium, T-H-E-L-I-U-M. Why? Because it's what really protects you from cardiovascular conditions. Now, it's a simple one-celled thick layer that lines all your blood vessels, and that means even the smallest capillaries. And according to James Harrison, who did a lot of good research on this, and I concur, there's one, and again, I'm making it really simple. I'm not going into coenzyme Q10 and NADH and all the other things I would suggest if you were sitting across me. Again, I want to look at the common denominator of least resistance, meaning people say, well, I'm not going to do anything if it's too complicated. Okay, how about this? Pomegranate. Pomegranate. Eat the pomegranate seeds, at least one whole one per day, or take the concentrates, and that protects your endothelium. It works on a number of levels to ensure cardiac health. It reduces cellular cholesterol accumulation. It protects your LDL from oxidation. And it shrinks atherosclerotic plaque. So to my friend, you're too smart to believe your doctor, who's too smart at honoring a paradigm that should have been surrendered a long time ago and get up to speed on what's really happening. Get ahead of the curve. Something as simple as pomegranate concentrate can help prevent heart attacks and strokes and other cardiovascular events. Time and again, it's been shown. Now, your chance of having a heart attack or a stroke depend a great deal on the health of your endothelium. The endothelium cells use nitric oxide to signal the need for relaxation to arterial muscle cells. So the older you get, you develop these pathological conditions like atherosclerosis, and our ability to produce and respond to nitric oxide rapidly diminishes. So when you rapidly diminish, you end up with more inflammation molecules that deplete nitric oxide production. And the result is endothelial dysfunction. That's a very serious dysfunction. It leads to artery stiffness and losing their ability to respond to changes in blood flow and pressure. And endothelial dysfunction is initiated as a result of oxidative stress. So in comes the pomegranate, and the pomegranate is able to interfere in that process. Also, another thing that interferes in the process is superoxide dismutase. Now, you can get superoxide dismutase by having 2 ounces of wheatgrass juice. It is terrific. Now, pomegranate supplementation can boost superoxide dismutase levels. It can do that. And superoxide dismutase is used for years as an injection to benefit people with joint disorders like arthritis. So this way you're also getting it from pomegranate. And you want to be able to remove arterial plaque. And that's what pomegranate does. Take it 3 times a day. There's no downside, only upside, and there are human studies to support that. So, summarize, your endothelium, the thin layer of cells lining your blood vessels, is the major regulator of blood flow and pressure, communicating with the smooth muscle cells via signaling molecules called nitric oxide. And aging increases oxidant stresses that destroy nitric oxide, while simultaneously reducing protective antioxidant mechanisms. This leads to atherosclerosis, formerly known as hardening of the arteries, which in turn is the major cause of heart attacks and strokes. Pomegranate extract, via several different but completely known mechanisms, restore your body's endothelial defenses, lower your risk for cardiovascular events, and help keep your arteries supple and youthful. And also, 1 glass of beet juice a day will make the difference. So, let's see. I don't see any calls, so let's say hello to, one, Paula from Florida. Hi, Paula.
Hello, Gary. It's Paula. How are you doing today?
Fine.
My husband, David, is under a severe attack of psoriasis. We have tried umpteen different things. Nothing is working.
Well, one thing you haven't changed is your belief systems. Stress is one of the number one causes of psoriasis. When you're stressed and you have elevation of cortisol and epinephrine and your blood sugar goes up because of stress, so de-stressing and having something that really excites you, not something that's a routine, not something that's a ritual, not something that people in gated communities or semi-retirement engage in, which just speeds up the death process, but something that excites and that also cleanses, something that you can do every day. Push yourself beyond the boundaries of detoxing. Do a really thorough, comprehensive, complete detoxification. My suggestion is find one of the many good centers around the United States. Go there and spend a month. Really de-stress, detox. Start doing yoga, meditation, things that make a difference. So you're not going to find this in a vitamin. It's a lifestyle. Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have a bunch of emails here. I have one here from Kate. Doesn't say where she's from. And she says, I am one of the million of millennials. And she says, we really can't afford all the things we need for our family, for our homes, and we can't really engage in the career of our choices today, even though Obama is saying how great the economy is. What advice can you give?
Millennials are making a big mistake. They're trying to do 2 things simultaneously. They're trying to have meaningful careers and a standard of living that historically been part of their parents' and grandparents' legacy of having a nice home. The trouble is, in the areas where they would be the most likely to find upper mobility, San Francisco, New York City, for example, those are also the highest. San Francisco right now has the highest housing in the United States. And yet it also has the highest growth factor for millennials in careers. Whereas if you went to Dayton, Ohio, you would end up having the least expensive housing, but also you'd have the least opportunity to grow in your job. So the cities in the states where you are not going to grow have less expensive housing. So it goes like this. If you want to be in Pittsburgh, San Jose, Salt Lake City, those are considered now dream cities. But also, you're going to have to go to the Rust Belt and some other places in the Southeast if you want to find affordable housing. I suggest you not look at buying a house at all. I don't believe anybody should buy houses right now because we're going into a major depression. I believe that what we should be doing is looking for quality of life. And millennials are going to have to get the idea that they've been lied to. They got education that frequently will not benefit them unless they're specializations, which will. They're living in environments that are too expensive, and they're creating massive debt. So why don't they start looking at shared communities, holistic communities, environmentally sound communities, where you can live inexpensively, you can develop other skills and traits that allow you to be able to barter and have fair exchange and be around other people who are also more idealistic and more environmentally sensitive and more green. That's the way I would go if I was a millennial today and did not have a career or one that I was happy with. I would get out of the cities. I'd get away from the expense. I don't want to go to the Rust Belt. I don't want to go to Akron. You know, I don't want to go to some of these cities where you could afford a house, but, you know, you could say go to Detroit. You can afford a house. Yeah, well, that'd be nice. No, it wouldn't. Where are you going to live there? So, but also don't deceive yourself that the only future is living in New York or one of these other very hot and very expensive places to live. That was my suggestion.
Did you say Pittsburgh was a green city?
No, I said Pittsburgh is one of the cities that's very expensive, but has a lot of opportunity for younger people. Remember, Pittsburgh is a university town.
Yeah, okay.
So there's a lot of industries in that area that younger people could get into. But these are also industries that are in computers and engineering and architecture, in medicine, in some of the basic sciences. For the majority of people going to college, they don't have a background in that. So now you're stuck with a degree that does not apply to where you want to live and cost of living that are beyond what your means are. So it makes no sense.
But it's endemic now, Gary. I work with so many people that have these huge student loans that have gone to college, and while they were in college, they were even working to pay off, you know, books and things like that. And now they can't find a job. They're living at home. They're struggling.
55% are living at home. However, the burden is not when they live at home. The burden is that 12 million senior citizens are having their bank accounts confiscated, their Social Security and wages, at least 30% of that is garnished because you can put liens against the income. And that's because they co-signed. What the students in America should do is join together in a national effort with supportive teachers and demand a law be changed so they can discharge these debts with bankruptcy and stop all compounded interest. In fact, take all interest to zero. That's what they should do. Now, you have enough students that politically you could do it. So you can't do it both ways. You can't be at home without a job where someone is going to be responsible for your bills, and that generally is your father or mother, grandfather, grandmother. And instead, you could be out there demonstrating. You could be out there writing articles about how we got these laws in the first place so you couldn't discharge your debt and why there's interest being made by the government of over $47 million a year, $47 billion a year from student loans. And you could change the laws. That's where they should put their energy. If they don't do that, then they are suffering from Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, okay? And there was recently a whole college campus shut down because there was somewhere in California they were raising the tuition, and all the students sat in and refused to pay the higher tuition. So that people are beginning to see this power in numbers. There's more and more people that are emailing me that are talking about gathering in groups and having power in numbers, and I think that's very, very significant.
I agree. That was University of California, Berkeley, and then it spread from there. But we should, that was just on, you see, the problem with that was they were complaining about the tuition increase, not the tuition per se. It was only the increase between the old tuition and the new tuition, which is about $500, $600. I'm saying shut down the entire university system in America. Stop the law that doesn't allow a person to get out of their debt with bankruptcy. Repeal all interest on these loans. That they could do. then you have a game changer. Then you don't create debt peonage. And then, while you're at it, stop all laws of debtors' prisons in the 27 states that have them. So now you're not going to go to jail for not paying your loans, which in 27 states you can. So you could do two things simultaneously: end debtors' prisons, and at the same time, stop the debt from these, and then start going to state colleges. This whole elitist idea that you're going to get the better education to Harvard is a myth. Now, I'm going to drive a stake through the heart of this stupidity on an upcoming two-hour special where I've got some of the best academic minds in the country talking about the myth that these Ivy League schools give you a better education. They don't. All right? So we should have free universities or minimal cost universities at the state level, and we should have more vocational schools, because at the end of the day, the person that has vocation is the one that's going to get a job. Thanks for your call. Let's say hello to Utrece Lead. Hi, Utrece.
Hello, Gary. Today it's Free Your Mind Friday, and listeners have their say.
Right back with you, Utrece Lead.